Friday, February the 4th, was a day to be remembered in the White House. It lived up to all its promise, and I, for once, was pleased with my part in it. In the morning, I practiced my little talk with Mrs. Provenson. There is no substitute for work, unless it's a soaring rocket of talent, and that's beside the point. And then to the beauty parlor, and then to work with Candy, transforming some of my Eastern fabrics into handsome at-home clothes, the small dinners that we have. He brought his mother, fresh over from Japan, and I met her in the library and arranged a tour and tea, and found a bolt of beautiful white brocade, which I thought might be good for Lucy's trousseau. How difficult those words come to my tongue. So I arranged to get her and Candy together to plan something lovely with it. And then a while of signing letters and reviewing my speech, flat on my back, because I find suddenly the last few weeks I'm quite weary, depleted. Today is sheer turmoil for Lyndon, getting ready to go tomorrow to Hawaii for about 3 days now. I've been hearing possibilities about it and being deaf and mute for fear I'd say something about it when I shouldn't. All the day really led up to presentation of the Eleanor Roosevelt portrait at 5 o'clock in the East Room. I wore my white satin and looked forward to it as eagerly as any party that ever happened in the White House. Warm, nostalgic, a gathering of many of us who worked together in the 30s and 40s. When I entered the East Room a moment or two after 5, there were seated in the front row 3 of the Roosevelt children, Anna Halsted and her husband, John and his wife, and Franklin Jr. and his wife. I shook hands with them all and then went straight to the podium. My little talk noted the presence, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, friends, those who knew her as First Lady, employer, and conscience of our country. Then I spoke about Douglas Shandor's use of Mrs. Roosevelt's hands. For Eleanor Roosevelt was a woman who had hands for the whole world, fine, strong, sensitive hands that ennobled everything they touched. And what I hoped was a humorous bit about the Constitution of the United States outlining the responsibilities and duties of the President, but not even mentioning the First Lady. No one, except her husband, chooses her. No one, except her husband and herself, defines her role. Given this vague mandate, a long line of American First Ladies have brought any number of admirable qualities to their times. The part I like best, we all know there's only one phrase for Eleanor Roosevelt. That phrase is human goodness, sheer, unalloyed, undivertible human goodness. If only all the little talks I have to make be put together to express my own feelings as comfortably and as well as this one. And I could remember that day very personally. In 38, or was it 39, Mrs. Roosevelt was our guest of honor at the 75th Congressional Club luncheon, which was a benefit to buy a wheelchair for a crippled boy. That was the day I got some movies of her. The closing was, I believe, one of the last lines from her last book, Life was meant to be lived. We must grasp every opportunity to live and experience life as deeply, as fully, and as widely as possible. This is such a big muddled world, and there is so much to be done. So very much that can be done. And then when I finished, a real pro took over. Mary Fickett, who had created the role of Eleanor Roosevelt in Sunrise at Campobello, read from some of Mrs. Roosevelt's autobiographical works, well-chosen selections, voiced by no means a mimic or a parody, but a very subtle slipping into the character of Mrs. Roosevelt, so charmingly done that I was caught up in the web of enchantment. It was something to laugh at, something to be proud of, to be sentimentally reminiscent about, and to be charged with determination to do your own part from the selections he read. I then invited everyone to come in the blue room where we could visit. We had pictures with all the children and grandchildren. Lyndon slipped into the line beside me, looking so tired my heart ached. And then they came, the family and fellow workers, the White House employees, all the people of the 30s and 40s. The Stuart Alsops were there, Susan Mary Alsop. Joe is in Hong Kong, I believe. And Marian Anderson, and the Thurman Arnolds, looking old but still gingery. Mabel Batchelor and Toinette Batchelor, and Mrs. Jim Barnes. Her husband's stag parties were always the event of the year for a decade or more in our early days. And Roberta Barrows, one of FDR's appointment secretaries, to whom Lyndon blew a kiss and said, "I hope my folks make everybody feel as good as you used to make me." Later, when a newspaper woman spoke to Miss Barrows, she described what a handsome young naval officer Lyndon was. And H.R. Balkage, what a familiar name as a commentator in those days. And Diane Hopkins, now Mrs. Allen Baxter, she'd spent 3 years of her childhood here with her daddy, Harry Hopkins. Old-timers from his administration, Francis Biddles, the Oscar Chapmans, and Tom Corcoran and Ben Cohen. How incomplete the party would have been without them. By this time, I was kissing all those who came down the line that were my own special friends. Oscar Cox's, impervious to time, very handsome, and among the old-timers for the press, Miss May Craig and Bess Furman, Mrs. Douglas Shandor, the widow of the artist, had flown up from Weatherford and was enjoying the party as much as anyone present. One of those I was happiest to see was Helen Gehagen Douglas, still lecturing, still very vital. Melvin is starting a new play in May. Later on, I gathered her up and Tex Goldschmidt, who is leaving for Asia next week. We sat down for a quiet drink in front of the fire. Dr. Elizabeth Drury, the rector of the FDR Library, who's been so helpful to us. And our very staunch old-time friend, India Edwards, and her husband. The house was alive with grandchildren. Later on, someone told me they had quite a reunion, and some of them saw each other for the first time in 20 years. There were two of James Roosevelt's daughters, the Anthony de Bonaventuras and the William Haddads, and lovely Chandler Roosevelt. She's Mrs. Henry D. Lindsley, Elliot Roosevelt's daughter, from Brownsville, Texas. I'm very fond of her. And the Douglas Lukes, she's John Roosevelt's daughter. But Christopher Roosevelt's, Franklin's son. David Roosevelt, who's Elliot's son. And the Franklin D. Roosevelt III's. And charming Tony Roosevelt, who is really Elliot Roosevelt Jr., who worked with us in the campaign of 60, and even before that, I believe. Joan Roosevelt, she's John's daughter. And the Van Seagraves, she is Sisty, Anna's daughter. The team of Sisty and Buzzy were the best known grandchildren in the days when FDR lived here. And it was she who had the only great-grandchild, her little daughter of about 10 years, present. I yearned for everybody to gather up their favorite old friends and get in corners with a drink and reminisce. And I believe to considerable extent that is how the party went. There were the Armand Hammers, my friends from Campobello, and the Victor Hammers, and Dr. Wayne Grover, who's guiding us through the labyrinth of how to put together a presidential library. And I was so delighted to see Averill Harriman with his hand cupped behind his ear, listening with interest. And William Hopkins, who said to me something like this as he went down the line, "There are only four of us left who were working here in those days." I was so glad to see Jane Ickes, and searched for her later, but unsuccessfully. And among press people of that day, the Robert Kentners and Doris Fleeson, this is one party I was particularly glad Doris came to. And although the party was for the hanging of Mrs. Roosevelt's portrait, Mrs. Nicholas Longworth was also a star at the party, as inevitably she would be. In her black hat, very vivacious, putting a note in Lyndon's pocket as she went down the line, she explained that it was a fan letter, and I could have hugged her right there, if she weren't so formidable. Many old friends of ours, the Jim Rose, Anna Rosenberg Hoffman, and a whole flock of Kermit Roosevelts. And from the real old-timers, Mrs. Nellie Taylor Ross, who had been director of the Met in FDR's administration. John Sullivan, who was former Secretary of the Navy. And Gladys Tillett, who's still going strong, bless her. It's hard to beat Southern women. Elegant and charming Marietta Tree. The Robert Wagners, looking bronzed and rested and happy. And it does my heart good to see him this way. And Roberta Vinson, she too was one of the ones I'd particularly wanted to come. And that was Mrs. Roosevelt's maid of 30 years, Mabel Webster, for whom we'd sent the car. And the party could not have been complete, we couldn't even have had it, without Grace Tully, one of our closest links to that day. A newspaper woman wrote, "The pageant of faces was like pages out of a history book come to life." And so it was. Many nice things happened. Among the nicest, Marian Anderson coming back to me after she'd been through the line and saying, "I want you to know I love you both very much." I know that all the newspaper girls, at least, were looking at the table and it was beautiful. This is a new chef's debut, though I missed my always most favorite thing. The sturdy steamship round of beef was elaborate and very decorative. Fires were burning merrily in all the rooms, even the state dining room, and guests were casually at home in every corner. It was about 7:30 when I went upstairs. I had a house guest, Roy White. He came down and we talked about the work on enlarging the two bedrooms at the ranch. I've decided not to do it this year. It's Lucy's wedding and all the decorating that needs to be done here in the White House. My intense interest in the library and the parks, all superimposed upon my real job of being Lyndon's wife and the First Lady, there is no time left, no strength, no me left to transform those two small rooms into the spacious, elegant quarters where I want to spend the rest of my life. I want to enjoy doing that, not endure it, not make a tour de force, a crash job out of it. And so I told Roy, let's shelve it, but let's keep our eyes open for lovely details, a mantle, some paneling, and I will search for an interior decorator. A little past 8, I went over to Lyndon's office and was successful, praise the Lord, in getting him to come home with me. He even left off his Dr. Peppers, had several scotch and sodas, and then a quiet dinner with Roy and me, and for the first time in a long time, we were in bed by 10 o'clock. His weight is creeping up a bit, about 195, and the lines in his face are deepening. So I am grateful for a moment of laughter from Corey and Gatto, or for a 10 o'clock bedtime. The leadership in the Senate especially is in a parlous situation. Mansfield's report on Vietnam has been hurtful, and Fulbright is, to say the least, an undermining force. Though small comfort he got in his open hearing on Vietnam with David Bell as witness, Bell was so dignified but quick with the answer, so courteous and able. Lyndon and I both talked to him after his 6 hours of testimony were finished. Lyndon is always quick to congratulate and thank any one of his troops who has been on television and has handled it well. There's a deep strain of appreciation in him for his fellow workers in this job, and I hope it is in turn appreciated.